The next story brings together two areas of special personal interest to me, archaeology and jokes. As you know, I'm fascinated with all things archaeological, and the other night you might have heard the chat we had with a couple of people who are digging away in Pompeii and who found, amongst other things, a very amusing bone belonging to a giraffe which seemed to have been eaten in a local restaurant. So there you go, there's a joke on archaeology straight off. But I've also spent decades collecting jokes, and at last count, I think Penguin have published 20 of our collections of jokes. And I find the mechanism of the joke, although of course it's only one form of humour, so fascinating. They often seem to me little acts of exorcism to deal with things we fear or resent. But there's more to them than that because, well, like sex and eating, jokes are universal, laughter is universal, but what makes us laugh varies enormously across place and time. The joke in particular, I think, is hugely revealing. It tells us about class, about power, bigotry, sexual practices, fears of the body, religious belief. But it can take a great deal of investigative work to understand what other cultures have found funny and why. Which brings us to looking at laughter, humour, power and transgression in Roman visual culture, 100 BC to AD 250. It's written by a Professor John Clark, and it's a surprising insight into the world of everyday Romans through an examination of the paintings and spectacles that made them giggle. Now, John is talking to us from his home in Austin, Texas. He's the Annie Laurie Howard Regents Professor of History of Art at the University of Texas. John, welcome to the program. Congratulations on a splendid book. And who the hell was Annie Laurie Howard?
Well, Annie Laurie Howard was a little old English teacher. Well, I shouldn't say old, but when she died, she and her sister had amassed some money because they invested well, and they decided to give it to their alma mater, the University of Texas. And in turn, they created an endowed professorship in my, which I have enjoyed very much over the last 15 years.
John, do you think that Annie Laurie Howard would be somewhat shocked by your book, given the enormous number of very big penises on display?
Well, I think she would have been shocked by the two that came out before that, Roman sex and looking at lovemaking, both of which have even more shocking images, I must say.
Okay.
I think so, but, you know, this is a very liberal environment, although it's in the middle of a state that's not so liberal.
I've always taken the view that, in fact, shock is very important to laughter. In the foreword to my first joke book, I talked about the first laugh of a child. And I observe it when I used to throw my little daughter up into the air and catch her on the way down. On the way up, this great intake of breath. My heavens, what is happening?
Yes.
And when safely landing in one's hands, the release of tension, which to me became the first laugh. Do you have a view about the origin of laughter?
I think laughter is extremely important in order to release stress and tension, and I think that it's also, as far as origins are concerned, as much psychosomatic as it is psychological. I think we feel the extreme joy of the loss of tension that comes when the ego loses hold, and I think that's why children giggle so much and, you know, talk to themselves and laugh at their own jokes. They don't have the fact checker, the superego running thing. I have a teacher of mine, Gangaji, I don't know if you know her, says that the greatest yoga is the yoga of laughter, because when you're laughing, you can't think. And there you are, home free.
In that case, I think we should laugh a lot more on this program, because I find thought really rather tiring. Which, of all the sources of humor, what do you think is the most relevant to Roman culture in the period you investigate? Does it involve the concept of the superego?
I think it does very much, because it's such a structured society. It's very class-oriented. And I kept finding more and more evidence for the notion of transgression, either transgression of lower classes, kind of stepping over the boundaries of what the upper class are are telling them to do, or transgression within classes. And so those kinds of behaviors, you know, when you have a very structured society, it's like, you know, the authority or the superego is looking after you, and you have to dress a certain way, you have to walk a certain way. And so they have all this humor that makes fun of people's physical appearance. A lot of it's very politically incorrect. It makes fun of deformed people, people who stutter, have red hair. There's a whole list of things. And then there's this very obvious send-up of intellectual pretensions, people who are pretending to be smarter than they are. So there's the intersection, I would say, of class and regulation. Social regulation.
Okay, now the visual humor in the book, of course, covers wall painting, sculpture, mosaics, ceramics, graffiti, inscriptions, and so on. And I should point out to the listener, is largely focused on Pompeii and Rome. Now, take us through some of the key motifs that occur again. And one of them, of course, is the aforementioned penis. And the other, perhaps more surprising, is the very large number of pygmies. What is going on here?
Well, the pygmies have become an obsession because they show up everywhere, and they're not real pygmies. They're an artistic and literary creation that goes all the way back to the Greeks. But the Romans start using the pygmies as fall guys, as kind of lightning rods for all sorts of inappropriate, as we say today, behavior. So we have the incontinent, sexually and digestively pygmy, doing all kinds of things, having sex out in the open on the Nile, picnics with crocodiles crashing the scene. They're fighting foolhardy battles with all sorts of creatures. And they appear all over Pompeian houses, but especially after the Egypt becomes a province. So that made me suspect.
There is the fantasy, isn't there, that pygmies are Egyptian, but that's not. It's totally inaccurate and not that important.
Well, no, and in fact, but the Romans weren't even able to get into Egypt without a visa, even after it became a province. You know, after Actium. So what we're looking at is a kind of othering of Egypt, using the pygmy as the representation of the fertility of the Nile, and of course they are armed with huge penises and do it wherever they can. And they're also a representation of what the barbarian is like, and so it's a funny way of dealing with Egypt.
Most of the jokes in the 21st century, numerically, I think, are about lawyers, an enormous number about viola players. I've never worked that one out. And, of course, an infinite number of jokes about sexuality.
Yeah.
The Romans seemed, of course, to be very relaxed on sexuality. They lived surrounded by pornography.
Well, we call it pornography, but for them, the representation of a couple, a man and a boy and a boy, a woman, and a man making love with a beautiful partner was a gift of Venus. I mean, they considered that to be the greatest gift of the gods.
Try telling that to a customs officer in Australia when you were bringing in even copies of Playboy.
Oh, good heavens. Well, yeah, what we have is a situation in the 21st century where we pretend to be very liberated sexually, but in fact, in many ways, our rules of behavior would have been very strange to the Romans. Now, not that they didn't have the rules, and that's where a lot of the sexual humor resides. A friend of mine, Luciano Iacobelli, uncovered a dressing room of a bath in 86, and it took us some time to puzzle it out, but we came to the same conclusion that these wild, outrageous representations of the kind of sex that Romans thought was improper were in fact humorous and meant to avert disaster. Now, the Romans also had this notion, I think it's an important one, of laughter dispelling evil spirits. And so in this dressing room, for instance, there are scenes of threesomes, foursomes, cunnilingus, fellatio, etc., all of which were, in fact, taboo by, let's say, elite standards.
I think people love to laugh at
them.
They're not too approved of, I believe, at your university in Texas, either.
Well, I can't say I haven't checked out everybody's bedroom, but.
Okay, now, I remember there's a wonderful story, and I think it has some basis in archaeological historic fact, that when the Greeks arrived in Egypt, they mocked the Egyptians' language by going bar, bar, bar at them, and out of which comes barbarism and barbarian.
Yeah.
And they also gave funny names to the giant edifices around them. You know, the pyramid was a little cake you could buy in the Athens street market, and the obelisk was a skewer on which you cooked your meat. Now,
so lovely.
Do you see the same sort of mocking in Roman humour in terms of its colonial power?
Well, yes, there is mocking of the other, and then, for instance, barbarians. What's wrong with them? They've got shaggy hair, it's red, they don't shave, and they have bodies that are too big and penises that are too big. So it goes completely against the ideal somatotype, which should be, you know, proper body, which should be kind of like the tanned, dark-haired man and the fair woman, but certainly not those outrageous redheads and blondes. another way of dealing with the barbarian is simply to say they can't talk right, which is your barbar story is absolutely correct. They give them funny names when they become slaves as well.
John, do you ever detect admiration for the other in Roman culture?
Yes, but usually in literature that's meant to show that people are a little perverse. For instance, one woman, her name is Bossa, I think, in one of Marshall's epigrams, has her special Syrian slave, but she makes him come to the bath with a brass sheath over his genitals because she doesn't want to share the sight of this glorious creature with anybody else.
What about the theme in your book, which has humorous imagery used in Roman culture to ward off evil?
Oh, that's where we get the really big members, the really big ones. The famous Priapus from the House of the Vettii, for instance, is weighing his member against a sack of gold, and guess which one is winning? These are images that go back to ancient beliefs that the world is full of demons. You know, today we think, well, I got sick, it's because there was a bug, you know, a virus or a bacterium. But in the ancient world, in fact, until not that fairly recently, even in our world, people believed that there were demons everywhere. And the demons were at crossroads, so you put up big phallic pillars there, or herms with erect penises on them. And you did this at the entrance to your house. And the idea was double. First, the fertility of the male member is this very powerful charm. You also, the so-called tension abuta, which are the bells hung with, the phalluses hung with bells, were often found over children's cribs to keep away the evil spirits. So it's fertility, but also laughter. And the laughter part hasn't been done very much, and so it's kind of what I did. Laughter dispels the evil eye, as well as the demons. And then the specific evil eye thing is very interesting. People believe that someone who envied you, your good looks or your fortune or anything at all, could focus the eye and cause you to die or get sick, which is why in situations where people see your bodies, for instance, in the dressing room of a bath, I was talking about one, a dressing room earlier on, you put funny images. This is pretty weird by our standards. We would never think that, you know, we could keep away the evil eye by hanging a phallic amulet around our neck or a phallic belt.
I've tried it, John. It doesn't work. I have to
report
that.
People just stare, right?
They yes, they do. It doesn't. You get a lot of eyes looking at you rather than anything else. Now, let's not dwell on the penis, although I'd like to, because as Mary Beard, writing about you, your book in the New York Reviews, pointed out, they're in every imaginable and some scarcely imaginable size and form. Perched over bread ovens with bells and wings in act of turning into a dog or being weighed, as you mentioned, against a large sack of gold. Tell me, I get that. I understand why that's funny. But what the hell is going on with that emphasis on the mocking of physical deformity?
Well, you know, part of it is, again, magical thinking. It's the thought that, and this, again, is counter to our culture, the thought, the belief in beauty being not skin deep, but the expression of the beauty of the individual soul. And Plato talks about this, the Greeks call it kala kagathos. Beautiful body is an expression of the beautiful soul. Therefore, if you have someone who is unbeautiful or has physical deformities, it means there's something wrong with their soul. And therefore, you use them as lightning rods for misfortune.
And of course, that goes from Rome to Rumpelstiltskin. And then and then the opposite occurs, and we start to find beauty in the beast.
Mm-hmm.
That it's didn't true. Happen in Rome.
Not so much. And what was very interesting is there was a forum of deformed people. You could go and buy deformed slaves as lightning rods, you know, as mascots. And of course, this continues into the courts of Europe in the early modern period.
Yes, in the Spanish court, for example,
yeah,
it was not unusual for a woman to have a pet chimpanzee to emphasize her beauty.
Yes, it's this contrast. You get the uglies around you, and you know, and they take care of all the misfortune. They become pets.
Yeah.
So this is highly politically incorrect today, and you know, of course, people might think that deformity is funny, but we never laugh at it directly.
Nothing was sacred in Roman visual humor. Now, you did detective work on some startlingly elite images that mock the gods, the emperor, the moral lessons of mythology.
Yes, I love that. It was a wonderful discovery. There are fragments of this frieze that was found in 1760, and finally tracked down where it came from. It came from a house in Pompeii, but we don't know much more about it. But one of them, there are twin representations that we know were set up in Augustus's forum in Rome, and it's Aeneas escaping Troy with his father, Anchises, on his shoulder, and little Ascanius trailing behind, straight from the Aeneid. And the other is Romulus with the spoils of his first great battle. And both of these are foundation myths that Augustus then uses in his forum to set up his propaganda machine, basically. Well, here's this person who paid an artist to make them into dog-headed apes with huge trailing phalluses. I mean, it's utterly subversive. I mean, that really is subversive. Of course, it's in a private home, and so you wouldn't let everybody see this picture, but you can imagine people howling with laughter when they saw, you know, they were just fed up with all of this stuff that was being, you know, handed down to them by...
And at the other end of the class scale, we have the low-class humor in your Tavern of the Seven Sages, and this would be very
place.
Comfortable to Australians because it's full of fart jokes, and most of the listeners to this program do like a good fart joke.
Well, it's amazing. There's you're thinking of the Kylon of Sparta. There's a representation. So in this, you go into this tavern, three of the sages are left, three and a half of the seven. But, you know, they say things like, know thyself and nothing too much, and people saw them everywhere. So they're represented as statues, very nicely painted, by the way, about 100 A.D. And you look up at Kylon, and here is his name in Greek, and then in Latin, very carefully lettered, it says, clever Kylon taught people how to fart without making noise.
Well, that would be a very useful skill on some social occasions, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so if one could do it without making stink, that would be even better.
I think that's even beyond his philosophical gifts. Look, John, it's great to talk to you. It's a beautiful book, incidentally, listener. It's full of splendid illustrations, some of them which I hope you don't look at. And the text is admirable. And it's by John Clark, Professor of History of Art at the University of Texas. The book is called Looking at Laughter, Humor, Power, and Transgression in Roman Visual Culture from 100 BC to AD 250. And it's published by the University of California Press. Good on you, John. Thanks for coming on the program.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. Thanks for calling.
And there'll be more humour on Transgression when Bruce Shapiro joins me from the latter-day Rome of Washington, and then veteran British diplomat Hilary Sinnott, who was the regional coordinator of the Coalition Provisional Authority, and he's giving his account of his time in Basra in southern Iraq. That's it for now. Stick around for the news on Radio National, and we will see you later.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.